I don't like to use the word crisis lightly, but I think crisis is the appropriate word here.
Senator Murkowski decries the collapse of several fisheries at the commercial fishing trade show in Kodiak. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 16th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, court officials defend the state's grand jury system against protests.
That does not mean that an individual citizen has a right to present anything directly to the grand jury.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Alaska's congressional delegation says species collapse in Alaska's fisheries is nearing crisis levels. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Representative Mary Paltola discussed the monumental challenges faced by Alaska's fishermen and coastal communities during their legislative update on the opening day today of Kodiak's annual commercial fishing trade show, ComFish. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth reports.
Senator Murkowski and Representative Paltola kicked off ComFish's federal legislative update with a brief acknowledgement of the Willow Project's recent approval, calling the $8 billion oil development a win for the state of Alaska. Senator Dan Sullivan was not at Thursday's forum due to a scheduling issue. He'll speak on Saturday instead. But much of their time was spent detailing the uncertainties caused by species collapse in the waters off Alaska's coast. Murkowski said the declines in salmon, crab, and halibut fisheries across the state are at crisis levels.
I don't like to use the word crisis lightly, but I think crisis is the appropriate word here. And I wish that we could all tell you the exact causes. I wish that there was one single thing to explain everything.
Population declines that were once acts of God are becoming trends of nature, Murkowski said, adding that current fisheries management doesn't always reflect what's happening in the water.
Our management systems are not inherently nimble, and that's a challenge for us.
Alaska's congressional delegation has been pushing for more funding to study the effects of ocean variability caused by climate change. Murkowski said that includes money for bottom trawl surveys and programs through the Pacific Salmon Treaty. Murkowski said nearly $3 million had been allocated for research in the Bering Sea. And money from the bipartisan infrastructure law will also help coastal communities facing reduced revenue streams from crashing fisheries. Paltola took time to call out bycatch, which is the incidental catch of a non-target species, saying not enough is being done to understand and address the issue.
I just really want to be clear that I personally feel like we can be doing better. Progress has been made, but we can't settle for the status quo. We need to make changes at a much faster pace than we are today.
In a follow-up forum later that day, members of the state's bycatch review task force detailed some of what those changes might be. The group published a series of recommendations late last year, including the development of a statewide bycatch policy and updating the types of gear and how much bycatch is allowed for certain vessels. But according to the task force, shifting distribution patterns of marine species as ocean temperatures change also presents a hurdle to developing effective solutions. Murkowski said there needs to be a collaborative approach to address the whole problem.
We need to be working together to find these solutions because the challenges really are too great for anybody to face alone.
That process will take time, although Paltola noted that probably wasn't satisfying for anyone in the room.
Even if we do everything right starting today, it still could take about 30 years for our fisheries to fully recover. And we really need to be clear about the timeline that we're looking at. But we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We can't hold ourselves back from making every marginal improvement we can.
Paltola and Murkowski spoke for about an hour, including a question and answer session. Both also addressed the lawsuit against Southeast Alaska's king salmon fishery brought by a Washington-based environmental group, saying it was an effort to bully the fleet and they would stand united in fighting it. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobroth.
Protesters concerned about limits on the power of Alaska grand juries spent 2 days this week advocating for their cause on the Kenai Peninsula and beyond. As KDLL's Riley Board reports, the issue is about a recent change to the grand jury process, which protesters believe limits the power of the juries in Alaska.
A coalition of protesters based in Kenai are standing up against what they see as unconstitutional limitations on the power of grand juries to investigate corrupt public officials and of the public's ability to access the juries. Grand juries are made up of citizens and decide whether there is enough evidence to charge a person with a crime. If a grand jury determines there is enough evidence, the case then goes to a trial jury. A group of advocates, including organizer David Haig, has been present at the last several Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly meetings to spotlight what they say is suppression of the power of grand juries.
So those folks are misleading you, trying to strip the power of grand juries to get to the bottom of what's going on so they can insert and steer what happens away from what we believe is systemic corruption involving numerous judges. And now we believe it involves all five Alaska Supreme Court justices.
Haig himself has been speaking out on the issue for years, following his own 2005 trial for unlawful game hunting, through which he was convicted on several counts. He alleges the Alaska Supreme Court is corrupt and has limited the power of grand juries to investigate corrupt judges and officials. The protests were energized again this last December when the court system amended its process for taking citizen requests for a grand jury investigation, making it so a citizen can approach the district attorney if they have an issue they'd like the grand jury to investigate. The court system says this was to accommodate a high volume of investigation requests from citizens. At the Assembly's Legislative Committee meeting Tuesday afternoon, Nancy Mead, general counsel for the Alaska court system, said citizens have never been able to approach grand juries directly.
Even though a grand jury has the constitutional authority to investigate, that does not mean that an individual citizen has a right to present anything directly to the grand jury. And this has never been the case.
This week, Haig and other advocates turned out to the Assembly meeting to support a resolution which requests the Alaska legislature hold hearings about the allegations of corruption. Assembly President Brent Johnson spoke against the resolution. He said he felt the issue was above his pay grade.
The bottom line is this. I'm really queasy when you're saying that we got the Supreme Court judges in Alaska and they're crooks, and you're saying you want them indicted. That's way out of my league.
Still, the Assembly passed the resolution 5-3 with one absence. The resolution only asks that the legislature host hearings and does not have any effect on borough code. The following morning, around a dozen protesters showed up at the Kenai courthouse at sunrise, many with signs reading, "Let the grand jury investigate." Although court system representatives say Alaskans have never been able to approach grand juries directly, Haig says he organized the protest to restore the right of the people to do so and to show the grand jury members they have support from the public.
There's some evidence that the Supreme Court bypassed their own rules committee to strip the grand jury of their power. So I'm going to take that evidence in and try to give it to the grand jury and ask that they investigate, just like the public is supposed to be able to.
The grand jury was not in session Wednesday, so Haig was unable to present the evidence he says he has. Haig also organized court sit-ins in Anchorage, Palmer, Juneau, and Fairbanks. A handful of supporters turned out to the courthouse in Fairbanks, and at least 20 individuals showed up at the Anchorage courthouse, according to a photo shared by Haig. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, climate scientists say the number of Arctic storms and the severity of those storms is increasing.
Large parts of Alaska, including Northwest Arctic Borough, are seeing more snow.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
Anchorage's municipal election is now underway after nearly 200,000 ballots were mailed out to registered voters on Tuesday. This week, Alaska Public Media reporter Jeremy Shea has been learning about who and what are on the ballot this year. He also visited the Anchorage Election Center to learn about the nuts and bolts of how the state's biggest local election is run. He joins us now to walk through some election questions. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Wesley.
So what's sticking out about Anchorage's 2023 municipal election?
Yeah, so the ballots are pretty long this year, depending on which assembly district or local service areas cover where you live. The questions could fill up to 4 pages. Voters are going to decide who will fill 7 seats on the Anchorage Assembly. That's more than half of that body, plus 2 seats on the Anchorage School Board and 31 seats of various local service area boards. There are also 15 ballot proposition questions.
That's a lot of ballot questions. Can you run through them?
Yeah, so 6 of them are bond authorizations. Bonds are a form of long-term debt that the city can take on with voter approval. These questions are asking voters to let the city borrow up to $84 million, most of which would be spent on school and road infrastructure. There are also bond questions for parks, new gear for firefighters, and public safety and bus system improvements. If approved, the debts would be repaid over time with property taxes. 5 more ballot propositions have to do with local service areas. These are jurisdictional carve-outs within Anchorage that geographically separate out who pays property taxes for hyperlocal services and projects. One of these questions would create a new Chugach State Park access service area that would covers the entire Anchorage Bowl. If that one goes through, then the idea is that those voters could be asked in the future to kick in some property taxes to improve access to the state park. There's one question to sweeten a residential property tax break. And finally, there are 3 charter amendment questions. 2 of those address some process-y governance issues. The most interesting one is the very last question on the ballot. It would dedicate the city's existing 5% marijuana sales tax to childcare and early education. Last year, this tax raised $5.8 million.
So how do Anchorage residents actually vote?
If you are registered to vote by March 5th, a package should be in the mail with election materials barcoded specifically for you. Your ballot is inside. You fill it out and remember to check both sides of the ballot cards. The ballot goes inside a secrecy sleeve, which you seal inside a return envelope that came in the package. On the outside of the envelope, you have to read and sign the declaration. Your ballot isn't valid without this signature. A pair of election workers trained in signature verification will eventually check this against one on file with the state, so don't be careless here. Then you can mail it in, drop it off at one of the municipality's 18 secure drop boxes, or, beginning March 27th, take it to one of 3 staffed Anchorage vote centers. The cutoff for postmarks or drop-offs is 8 p.m. on April 4th.
And can people vote in person?
Sort of. There are no neighborhood polling places. However, you can still take your ballot package to one of 3 Anchorage vote centers and fill it out in a booth there beginning March 27th.
And when are we going to know the results of the municipal election?
So election workers won't begin counting votes until after voting closes at 8 p.m. on election night. Again, that's April 4th. Election officials plan to begin publishing partial, unofficial results on the city's website around 8:30 p.m. that night. Election Administrator Jamie Hines said she expects to publish updates each evening that week. After that, the pace of updates will slow down as fewer and fewer valid ballots trickle in. But on a peak day, Hines said election workers can process about 10,000 ballots. For context, about 70,000 ballots were cast in Anchorage's last regular election.
And where can we learn more about the candidates and the issues on the ballot?
For the Anchorage Assembly and the Anchorage School Board candidates, Alaska Public Media partnered with the Anchorage Daily News to build a candidate comparison tool. Readers and listeners helped inform the questions we asked. That should be live on our websites by the time you hear this. And the city publishes information about the ballot propositions on its election website.
Well, that's Alaska Public Media reporter Jeremy Shea. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
International fashion model and native activist Koyana Chasing Horse spoke Monday in Fairbanks on the opening day of the Tanana Chiefs Conference Annual Convention. The 20-year-old Chasing Horse is Han Gwichin and Oglala Lakota and spent a good portion of her youth with family in interior Alaska. Her childhood dream of being a model took a major step forward in 2020 when she was selected for a Calvin Klein ad campaign, and she's since appeared on magazine covers and runways around the world. Chasing Horse credits Native culture with helping her navigate a characteristically superficial business.
Bring a sense of realness and a sense of humanity to that industry.
Chasing Horse talked about the challenge of being an Indigenous person in the fashion world.
A lot of people want me to fit into their stereotypical box that they create of Native Americans, but it's simply not who we are. I am not your Pocahontas. I am not some Native Barbie doll.
Chasing Horse recounted being asked to cover her traditional tattoos and dye her hair, and how she instead makes the industry work for her.
And I made sure that everyone understood in that industry that when you work with me, you work with all of me. And all of me is my people.
As one of the first Native American models and the first with traditional tattoos, Chasing Horse said she's empowered by her difference.
I can proudly now stand in front of a mirror and look into that mirror and see my ancestors staring right back at me, because I carry the same features that they carry.
Chasing Horse says she's selective about who she works for and asks questions about sustainability and other values, and that's taught her something.
It has become apparent that the world is hungry for what we have, and that is community and solidarity, that is culture, that is respect for the land and our animal relatives.
Chasing Horse says those values are especially important right now in light of climate change and other environmental challenges. Meanwhile, the Juneau School Board adopted a $96 million budget on Tuesday based on an assumed increase in state and city funding. KTOO's Katie Anastas has more.
The Juneau School Board approved a budget based on a key assumption, that the base student allocation, the amount of per student funding from the state, will increase by at least $430 next year. That BSA increase would give the district $3.3 million more than it got from the state this year. Superintendent Bridget Weiss spoke at the beginning of Tuesday's board meeting.
There are estimates built in here, and one of those is that increase to BSA.
Last month, the school board voted to build its budget around a $430 increase. The idea was to use a more conservative estimate than the $1,000 increase legislators have proposed. But the BSA is only guaranteed to go up by $30 next year. If lawmakers don't further increase it, Juneau school district leaders will have to make budget cuts. Weiss said that would likely involve increasing the pupil-to-teacher ratio, essentially making class sizes bigger.
So that's a lever that you likely would have to use if that worst-case scenario happened.
Stacey Joof, principal of Site Gastineau Community School, said she was worried about the board's assumption that the BSA would increase more than $30.
It does deeply concern me that we're banking on such an increase from the state, and the optimist in me really hopes that it happens, but the realist in me is very concerned.
Other school districts in Alaska, including the Anchorage School District, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District, and the Kodiak Island Borough School District, have built their budgets around the $30 increase. The only staff cuts in Juneau's approved budget are to six elementary school library assistant positions. The district plans to use $1.6 million in remaining COVID relief money to pay for some teachers and online classroom materials. Cassie Olin, the district's administrative services director, says administrators are considering reducing school bus service next year in order to save money.
We're trying to figure out the best combination of consolidation and if we can consolidate some of our buses together so that we can decrease our routes.
The district's budget also assumes they'll get the maximum amount of money the city is allowed to contribute, along with $2.5 million in outside the cap funding. The district must submit its budget to the city for final approval by April 5th. In Juneau, I'm Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Thanks for listening today. We love being a part of your media mix. Tune in every day to catch the best in statewide news and programming.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
One of the world's largest sea stars is on track to receive protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act. As reported by the Alaska Beacon, federal regulators announced this week that they are proposing a threatened listing for the sunflower sea star. The creature has been killed off in much of its Pacific habitat by disease. While the effect of a listing on Alaska and its fisheries is not certain, scientists say they don't expect significant changes in the state in the near term. Sunflower sea stars are found from Baja California to Alaska's Aleutian Islands. They can grow up to 24 legs and be as big as 3 feet in diameter. If the listing goes through, it will be the first for any sea star under the Endangered Species Act. A disease known as sea star wasting syndrome has wiped out about 90% of the animals across its vast range, according to federal scientists. It has hit a variety of sea star species, though sunflower sea stars have suffered especially severe harm. It causes legs to fall off and ultimately results in disintegration of the animals' bodies. Climate change may be behind the disease. The arrival of Pacific marine heat waves has coincided with outbreaks of it. The heaviest impacts of the disease have been in the southern areas of the species range. There have been less severe impacts in Alaska and other northern areas. But the listing would cover sunflower sea stars over their entire range. That's because the Endangered Species Act does not allow listings of invertebrates to be broken down into distinct population segments, which is the case in Alaska, with endangered western Steller sea lions and Cook Inlet beluga whales. Mike Williams Sr. is more than just a veteran of the Iditarod. He's a dad with a son still out on the trail. He also has 15 Iditarods under his belt. As someone who has worked many years to keep the sport of mushing alive in Alaska Native communities, this year seems to have made it all worthwhile. Veteran Iditarod musher Mike Williams Sr. is in Nome for the finish of the Iditarod. His son Mike Jr. is still out on the trail, taking it slow to groom a young team of dogs. He returned to the race this year after a 5-year break from the sport. He's the fourth Alaska Native in this year's Iditarod. The other three, Ryan Reddington, Pete Kaiser, and Richie Deal, were the first to cross the finish line. Williams Sr. says Tuesday's finish was a proud moment to see not just one Native musher in the top spot, but three.
It's a joy. It's something very special. 1, 2, 3. And it says a lot that mushing is still alive in our communities.
Williams, who is Yupik, has run the Iditarod 15 times. He says he entered his first race in 1992 because the number of Native mushers was in sharp decline, mainly because they couldn't afford to compete against a new class of well-financed professional mushers. He hopes Reddington, Kaiser, and Deal's successful runs will help draw more sponsors for up-and-coming Native mushers. Williams says the traditional use of dogs for hunting and travel was key to survival and required a mastery of the land in one of the harshest environments on the planet. He says Native culture is really the backbone of the sport, so it's good to see Alaska Native mushers sweep the top spots.
He would be very proud that he accomplished something like this.
Williams also ran many Iditarods with Ryan Reddington's late grandfather, Joe, who founded the race. Although many members of the Reddington family have competed in the Iditarod, Ryan is the first to claim the trophy, which bears the image of his grandfather. Williams says the father of the Iditarod believed any musher who crossed the finish line deserved to be called a winner. He says he feels the same way about his son, Mike Jr., who is on the last stretch of trail about 25 miles from Nome. Meanwhile, a series of record-breaking storms that hit the Northwest Arctic and Bering Straits region in early March brought heavy snowfall and high winds up to 55 miles per hour. The city of Kotzebue issued a disaster declaration after the storm's impact threatened emergency services and knocked out vital infrastructure. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, climatologists say these heavy mid to late winter storms might become more common and signify a climatic shift for the region.
The blizzard that hit Kotzebue in early March was one of the largest storm events in recent years. The National Weather Service recorded the highest 1- and 3-day precipitation amounts for the month of March from the Kotzebue Airport. Brian Brettschneider is a physical scientist with the National Weather Service based in Anchorage.
It's certainly exceptional. You know, the reports that I've seen for the snow and the wind and the blizzard conditions, you know, really are quite remarkable.
Brettschneider says the moisture level was extraordinary, but there's a caveat. There are many metrics for how to measure the intensity of storms. That can include wind speed, moisture level, low pressure system, and storm tracks. Brettschneider says while the precipitation was record-breaking, measuring snow amounts along the tundra is notoriously difficult.
I mean, you could have, you know, a 5-foot snowdrift one day and you know, the next day it's been blown away and moved, you know, moved a little bit farther away. And so how do you measure that?
Rick Toman is a climate specialist for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says while the Northwest Arctic's recent storms were record-breaking, as a whole, Kotzebue has not had a particularly stormy winter. What's more fascinating, he believes, could be the changing seasonality of storms.
Large parts of Alaska, including Northwest Arctic Borough, are seeing more snow in the midwinter than there used to be. That's mostly counterbalancing a decline in autumn snowfall.
Toman says a team at the University of Alaska Fairbanks is actively researching the trend.
So this is all very cutting-edge work.
Both Toman and Brett Schneider agree that warming temperatures causing melting sea ice in the Bering Sea could bring about more intense storms, like the recent snowstorms or the devastating Typhoon Murbach, which hit western Alaska in September. Toman says, in general, Alaska's experiencing more intense storms, from the Arctic to southeast.
From the rains that produced the fatal landslide in Haines in December 2020, Kotzebue, Nome, Utqiagvik have all set their all-time one-day precipitation records in the last 3 years. Many places have had these big events, you know, the tremendous snows in Anchorage in December.
Brett Schneider says that higher latitude areas like the Arctic will continue to experience more precipitation due to warming temperature from polar amplification, also known as the albedo effect.
And so without snow on the ground, the high latitude areas are just absorbing solar energy when in the past, much of that time it was reflecting solar energy away. And the same is true of sea ice. You know, the Bering Sea used to have a lot more ice in it, you know, all the way through April and May and even into June than it does now.
A 2022 study reports the Arctic as a whole has warmed at a rate 4 times higher than the rest of the planet over the last 40 years. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Riley Board in Kenai, Jeremy Shea and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Katie Anastas in Juneau, and Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media runs on membership. Thank you for supporting this station with a donation today. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.